Please record.
Great.
Okay, Dave, you can take it away.
Okay.
Excuse me. This is the operator. I just need to inform everyone today's conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. Ms. Jones, you may begin.
Thank you, and I'm going to turn it over to Dave Seal.
Okay, thanks, Jane. Okay, where are you now? This is, again, we had a nighttime launch on October 15th of 1997 from Kennedy Space Center. We spent nearly 7 years cruising through the inner solar system. We launched really an enormous spacecraft that was packed with instruments covering the entire electromagnetic spectrum as far as observations that we could accomplish. Because the spacecraft was so big and so powerful, the largest spacecraft that was really feasibly at the disposal of NASA could not launch it directly to Saturn. We used the planets of the inner solar system, first Venus twice, then the Earth, and then a small kick from Jupiter to get us out to Saturn. And it really offered us a great advantage because using those the inner solar system planets really allowed us to send this enormous and really very capable spacecraft to Saturn, whereas we would have had to send something much smaller to go there directly. You can see from the graph on the right the trajectory that it took to get us out to Saturn. We launched sort of near the middle bottom below the sun there on October 1997. We followed the green leg until our first Venus flyby, which was in June of 99, not quite 2 years later. We then had a long leg out almost near to the orbit of Mars, executed a deep space maneuver near the end of 1998, and then came back for a rather quick Venus to Earth leg. The second Venus swing by, you can see sort of near to the upper left of the sun, was in June of 99, and then we had an Earth swing by below the sun there less than 2 months later in August of 99, which is a very interesting and intense period for us. We made it out to Jupiter and had a lot of good scientific observations at Jupiter near the very end of 2000. And after about 3.5 years of, in July 1st of 2004 was our arrival at Saturn. So we've been at Saturn for nearly 2 years, and hopefully the rest of the telecon you can get a feel for all the great things we've done to date. Page 3 is an illustration of the Cassini spacecraft. Most of what you see here is actually covered with thermal blanketing, which is gold in color and called Kapton, but that blanketing has been removed for this image just so you can see a lot more of the hardware that composes this Cassini spacecraft. Again, the Huygens antenna and much of the communication system is near the top. We've got an 11-meter magnetometer boom that's extending out after the end of the screens, after the end of the screen to the left. Some of the instruments are illustrated here. We've got a dust analyzer that's on the left side of the spacecraft in this view, as well as the most of the remote sensing instrumentation, which is sort of on the front of the spacecraft from this view. There's fields and particles components on the right. You can see just below the Huygens antenna the sort of 12-sided structure, which contains all of nearly all of the electronics, all of the both strings of the main computer as well as the attitude control computer, most of the Cassini instrumentation is located here, if it's not in the instrument itself, as well as all of the data processing functions and storage. Near the bottom of the spacecraft, you can see three radioisotope thermoelectric generators. These provide us with just under 700 watts of power right now. We lose about 1 watt a month just from the process of how the radioisotopes undergo fission, but it's really more than enough power to operate the instruments in different suites of modes that are appropriate for whatever observations we're taking. At the very bottom, you see we have 200-pound engines. That's about 490 newtons. They're redundant, and these engines are used to execute all of the major maneuvers of the spacecraft. Again, the spacecraft is enormous. It's really the size and weight of a decent-sized school bus, and because we we're able to use the inner solar system planets. We've been able to launch all of these great instruments to make sort of coincidental, if not simultaneous, measurements of all of the interesting features of the Saturnian system. Our solid-state recorder is half a gigabyte. It's about the size of what you can store on a CD, which may not seem like a lot nowadays, but when the spacecraft was being designed in its final stages in the early to mid-90s, it was an impressive amount of data. And because we downlink to Earth every day, you know, if we choose to, and if the scientific observations permit, we can fill this recorder every day and empty it every day, and collect really a staggering quantity of data about Saturn. On page 4, this is an illustration of nearly all of the bodies and features of the Saturnian system that we've discovered to date. On the top, you can see illustrations of the various satellites that we've discovered. These are nearly all to scale. There's a handful that have asterisks after them, which are rather small, and the sizes of them have been exaggerated. But you can see from the top that Saturn really is almost a solar system in and of itself. It's got a large number of moons that span a wide range of diversity in terms of surface features and appearance and size. On the bottom half of the chart, you can see, at least for the first half a dozen or so major satellites, you can sort of see what their rivers are from Saturn. You also see illustrated here where the different spacecraft that have visited Saturn crossed through the ring plane and made, among other things, dust measurements at those points. You can see beyond the main rings of Saturn, there are two fainter rings, the G ring and the E ring. The brightnesses of those rings in this illustration, depending on your computer screen, may look very exaggerated, but it's an illustration to show sort of where in the Saturn system they're located. Okay, going on to page 5. Again, we're halfway through our 4-year prime mission. The prime mission in total is 75 orbits, 45 targeted, which usually means close, and it usually means that there's a very concentrated suite of observations that's planned for that time period. So there's 45 targeted Titan flybys, 8 targeted flybys of the other satellites, the icy satellites of Saturn, and there are many dozens of more distant non-targeted flybys and observations that we also have. Our science objectives are split into 5 major themes: Titan, Saturn, the rings, the icy satellites, and the Vega sphere. And there's a link here. I think the one at the bottom, at least in my chart, is the one that's fully delineated. The other one that says pedal movie, may be cut off depending on what chart you're looking at. But there are some great movies, not only in the Charm link, but also in the link that's on the bottom. And the what we call, with some humor, the spaghetti plot you can see there on the right sort of is an illustration of how diverse our orbits are. Each orbit is really unique from the other ones, and via the spaghetti plot you can see that we really tour nearly all of the regions of the Saturn system in our 4-year tour. Page 6. All orbiter systems are performing normally. The spacecraft is really been frighteningly healthy, with really almost no anomalies or problems to speak of. All of our consumables usage, how much fuel we've used, etc., our power has trended, are either running according to the predict or actually doing considerably better than we expected. Our use of hydrazine, which is our fuel we use for small maneuvers and attitude control, is really running quite a bit better than we've expected, and we anticipate having at least half the tank left over for any extended mission that we could do after the 4 years are over. We just completed what we call the occultation phase and are about to begin the magnetotail phase of the mission. Again, occultations are where Saturn passes in front of a body, usually either the Sun or the Earth or a star, and the rings as well. By measuring the signal strength from the source, you can tell a lot about the various bodies are studying the Saturn atmosphere as well as the rings. What we're doing now is sort of rotating the orbit out to the magnetotail, which is the direction that's opposite the direction from the Sun if you're looking at Saturn. The rings of Saturn, again, as it states here, close during the mission, which is why we've done the occultations, some of the occultations early in the mission. particularly over the summer of 2005. We've had some equatorial orbits that we use to do icy satellite flybys, and again now we're rotating to the magnetotail to continue on with our other themes of science observation. 14 orbits have been completed. Again, 13 targeted flybys, 45 non-targeted flybys, which are about 100,000 kilometers or less to date, as you can see at the bottom of page 6. Page 7 is a bit dense, but it's an illustration of sort of what the various activities are during the mission. At the very top, you can see those are targeted encounters, where the letter indicates the name of the satellite. The orange T's are for Titan. We're pretty much in the middle of this plot, so you can see that there are a lot of Titan flybys have been executed to date, as well as most of the targeted icy satellite flybys. Those are the blue letters. It starts with Phoebe to the left. You can see we've had some Enceladus encounters, as well as some close Hyperion, which is the H, and then Dione and Rhea. The next section down is sort of the non-targeted encounters, and you could take the one or two letter identifiers and connect them with the satellite name that was listed on page 4. There's a middle part that shows occultations. You can see there was a rather dense period of occultations from the T's and the S's in the summer of 2005. And then you've got sort of an orbit plot that shows distance from Saturn with time. You can see on the next plot down that our inclination was very low up until about now, and where once we reach the magnetotail, we'll start raising inclination. You can see sort of in the late summer and early fall of 2006, until we reach an inclination of about 50 to 60 degrees for about 6 months, centered on the new year coming up. On to page 8. Again, here's the second year targeted flyby summary. We started with targeted Enceladus encounter in July of 2005. We went on for icy satellites to get close to Hyperion, Tethys, Dione, and Rhea. And you can also see there were like 9 targeted Titan flybys as well in the second year tour. Let's see. To date, on page 9, we've returned a large amount of data, 60 gigabytes. We've done a number of trajectory tweaks to account not only for retargeting and gaining some icy satellite encounters, but also to account for Titan's atmosphere being somewhat denser than we expected. None of these trajectory alterations have significantly degraded really any measurable aspect of the mission, and a number of the tweaks, in fact, have actually given us enhancement. That's why we've done some of them. A lot of the work we've done in the last few months has been focused on preliminary planning for the extended mission. We had a lot of discussion in France amongst the science community about what the priorities should be based on what we know now. We have initial inputs from all of the instruments and all of the disciplines. We have nearly a dozen tours that have been, the sample tours that have been released for people to look at and study.
You're going to be late.
We had some consensus in a number of areas that was good at the June Project Science meeting, and we'll continue on with our future science meetings in October and then in 2007 to refine our plans for the extended mission. That concludes the mission overview section. We're at page 10 right now, and if there are any questions, I'd be happy to take them.
Yeah, hi, I've got a question. My name's Ken Kramer. I'm an ambassador from Princeton.
Hi, Ken.
Hi. My question is just about these tours. Do they vary greatly? What would be the significant differences in them?
Yeah, for the extended mission tours, the trade space for what science priorities we go after for the extended mission is still very wide open. We're trying to focus the effort now, and that's we've made a lot of good progress at the science meeting in France. But the tours to date have really spanned almost every corner of the Saturn system, and some of them stayed high in inclination above the ring plane, and many of them came down to the ring plane and rotated in various directions. So there really were very few limits placed on the tour development to date. But I think we got a lot of good input, and we'll be focusing on a rather smaller subset of tours from here on. And our goal is to select the final tour and pretty much have it ready in May of next year. So we've got, you know, about 10 months to complete all of this work and study. Okay, any other questions?
Hello, this is Matthew Ota with the Saturn Observation Campaign.
Hi, Matthew.
Yeah, my question is on these high inclination orbits, and I noticed that they are very eccentric orbits. I wanted to know if the imaging team will be getting some images of Saturn's atmosphere in the polar region and studying the circulation of the polar areas.
Okay, I think I'll let Andy or Elizabeth answer that one.
The answer is yes, of course. But I'll tell you about it in half an hour.
Okay, very good. Thank you.
Great. Okay, if anything, I probably went a bit late, so on to the next presentation, which is Dr. Andy Ingersoll from Cassini Imaging Team. Take it away, Andy.
Hi there. Everyone turn to slide number 10. This is the March 10th, 2006 issue of Science Magazine, which had a suite of articles from different instrument teams devoted to Enceladus. Enceladus was discovered in 1789 by William Herschel, and it's a 500 kilometer diameter moon, fairly close into Saturn. There's a bunch of little moons that were discovered in the 20th century in closer, and there's one William Herschel type moon, Mimas, inside Enceladus, but it's pretty close into the planet. And the amazing thing is how active it is. It's spewing out material, it's warm, it's internally heated, it's geologically active, and that's amazing for a cold little object in the outer solar system. And Cassini really learned a lot about it, and that's what I'm going to tell you. So move on to slide 11. This is a Voyager image taken in 1981, and it excited a lot of people because you see that sort of craterless area. Well, there are a number of craterless areas, but there is one in particular that sort of goes up like a hour hand to pointing toward 12. It looks like something flowed out on the surface and partially covered some of those craters. The fact that there are so few or even no craters on that flow feature means that it's geologically young, and that means probably it's Enceladus is geologically active. So even in 1981, people were excited about it. At the time, the candidate for the flowing liquid was an ammonia water mixture, which stays liquid down to almost 100 degrees, minus 100 degrees Celsius. Let's move on. There were other hints, though. Slide 12 shows an edge-on picture of the ring system. The ABC rings are overexposed in this picture. This was taken from Earth as the Earth and the Sun were going through the plane of the rings, which minimizes the light from the ABC rings. But then you see the E ring and the G ring. Now, the E ring has its maximum density right at the orbit of Enceladus, and this is suggestive that Enceladus is giving off particles some way, one way or the other, and that's further evidence that it's active in some way. The last evidence before Cassini really had its close flybys is slide 13, where you see atomic oxygen. That's just neutral oxygen atoms floating around. The two ellipses there, the inner one is the orbit of Enceladus, and the outer one is the orbit of Dione, and you can see that the brightest, the maximum amount of oxygen is right there at the orbit of Enceladus. But hydrogen is also detected there, and OH, a simple sort of water-like molecule without with missing one hydrogen, has also been detected there. So this suggests that water itself is being released from Enceladus in some way or another. This is also, this is, I believe, 2004. Moving on to slide 14. In early 2005, the spacecraft made a few sort of close, but not too close, passes of Enceladus. And the magnetometer in particular detected some distortion in the magnetic field. And the distortion was rather peculiar. It had the signature of a ionized plasma in the vicinity of Enceladus, some kind of electrical conducting gas, but it wasn't centered on Enceladus. It was centered off to the south of Enceladus, as shown in slide 14. And so that was interesting enough that the people who actually run the spacecraft were willing, after they saw this data, to change the orbit of the spacecraft so that we took a close flyby of Enceladus right over the South Pole, or south of the South Pole, and to go through this plume, if it was indeed a plume. So that close flyby was done on July 14th, 2005. And these, now on slide 15, you can see some of the discoveries. This is the imaging system, and with the geometry of both of these images is that the sun is almost behind the satellite. So you're seeing a very thin crescent illuminated, and the rest of the satellite is dark. And emanating from the crescent are these little streaks of particles, streams of particles, and when you overexpose the image, you can see that they're going off several radii away from the planet. The little streaks in the B image are stars in the long exposure, but you can see that some of the particles are just leaving the satellite altogether. So there are plumes, there are geysers, some kind of jets on Enceladus, which is amazing just in and of itself. Slide 16, if you're looking at the PowerPoint, you will actually see motion here. As far as we can tell, the motion is due to the motion of the spacecraft as it took several images as it was receding away from Enceladus. But by looking at these four images over and over, we are able to tell where on the surface of Enceladus these jets are coming from. And that's in the next slide. They're coming from the South Pole region. Some of the best determined ones are A, B, and C, and you can see they're coming from this crack down in the South Pole region, which is a little trough about 2 kilometers wide and 400, 500 meters deep. And so the jets are apparently coming from these troughs, which we, for some reason, someone named Tiger Stripes. Here's the whole picture, slide 18, of the South Pole. The South Pole is right in the middle of those stripes. And they are indeed blue. They're basically the blue color of a block of ice. And the implication is that there are rather large by our standards, maybe size of sand grain, ice crystals, near these Tiger Stripes, which are, as I've told you, the source of the plumes. Now, if you can also see, sort of surrounding the Tiger Stripes, there's a sort of polygonal pattern of strange cracks that, when we look at them closely, this sort of polygonal pattern that surrounds the South Pole is compressional features. And then you'll see cracks that emanate all the way up north, right off the edge of the planet. Those are extensional features. They sort of cross the equator, actually. And next slide, slide 19, shows you red, a view right looking straight down on the South Pole. Red is the compressional features, and blue are the extensional features. This is the kind of cracking pattern you get if the satellite were spherical at one point and then became flattened. But we don't quite know why that happened, but it certainly looks as if it did. The tiger stripes themselves are more mysterious, and we don't understand them. There are no tiger stripes in the North Pole, which is a further mystery. But, of course, discovering mysteries is what we want to do in this business, and then we want to solve them. Slide 20 shows the crater density on various places on Enceladus, and you can see that there are some places that are heavily cratered, and the lowest curve is the area of the tiger stripes, and there's actually no craters in this size range in the tiger stripes. That lowest curve is just an upper bound, and from the absence of craters in the vicinity of the tiger stripes, you can infer that that surface has been resurfaced in the past few million years, which is a very short amount of time on geologic time scale. Well, we did take some very close-up images, and slide 21 shows you our best one of the area near the tiger stripes. The resolution here is about 2 meters per pixel, and these lumps that you see here are maybe 10-meter size boulders, and we have no idea what they're doing there, how they got there. I'm sure some of my friends in the imaging team have theories, but they are they were surprised, and they're quite mysterious. I told you that these plumes are extending off the planet. That's the next slide. Let's move on from that one. There are other instruments. So slide 23 shows you what the ultraviolet spectrometer did. They watched a star, 2 stars actually. The A and B show path of 1 star as it apparently, I mean, of course the star wasn't moving, but the spacecraft was moving, so the star appeared to move behind Enceladus, and that's the path that the star took, and shown in A, and C and D shows the path that the second star, Gamma Orionis, took. And you'll see that in D, that star passed right through the plumes emanating from the South Pole. And so looking at how the starlight was absorbed, looking at how the starlight was absorbed became very interesting, because we were able to measure the spectrum of that absorption and determine what the plumes were made of. And the next slide, which is slide 24, shows the spectrum. This is ultraviolet from 1200 angstroms to 1800 angstroms. The light curve is the spectrum of that was measured, the absorption of that starlight, and the heavier curve is the spectrum of water vapor. And you can see over on the left, around 1200 angstroms, it matches water vapor very well. It also matches the slow, the long undulation off to the right. And it actually it represents a certain amount of water vapor in the path between the instrument and the star. And that's another hint that this plumes are made of water. Next slide, slide 25, is the results of another instrument. This is the near-infrared mapping spectrometer, VIMS, and they also take spectra, and they find evidence of water ice all over the satellite. They also, if you look down center, 3.44 micron organic absorption, that's really, they can see the spectrum of the chemical bond between carbon and hydrogen. And you'll notice that chemical bond shows up in some kind of organic molecule. Could be methane, ethane, or benzene. It could be a lot of different things. Some kind of organic molecule shows up in the region of the South Pole. In fact, it's aligned with the Tiger Stripe. So you got organic molecules, you got water, and pretty interesting stuff. Now, those are remote sensing instruments. Turn to slide 26, and you'll see the path of the spacecraft as it flew close to Enceladus. And there were several instruments that sampled the medium that they were flying through, not sort of in situ measurements. The INMS is a measures the molecular weight of molecules and identifies their composition that way. And CDA measures particles and measures their size distribution. So moving on to 27, you can see the molecular weight of the molecules that the INMS instrument detects. And if you recall your chemistry, the biggest peak there is molecular weight 18. That's oxygen, which is 16, and plus two hydrogens, that's 18. That's water. Hey. Then the big peak over to the right is mass 44, which is a carbon and two oxygens. The carbon is 12, and each oxygen is 16, so that's mass 44. So that they were detecting carbon dioxide as well. Then the third peak is mass 28, which is ambiguous because it could be two nitrogens, 14 plus 14, or it could be carbon monoxide, a carbon and an oxygen. But carbon monoxide was not seen anywhere else, so the thinking is that that's nitrogen, N2. You'll also notice that the water peak at mass 18 has sort of a shoulder down to 16, and that's probably methane, CH4, and so it goes. But further evidence that the plumes are reaching the altitude of the spacecraft, that there's water, CO2, nitrogen, and some organic molecules, so even evidence of acetylene, C2H2, and propane, C3H8. Okay, slide 28 shows the results of the infrared radiometer, SPHERES. And another amazing thing about the Tiger Stripes is that they're warm. You've got to remember that this is the outer solar system, and sunlight can't warm the South Pole up to 85 degrees Kelvin. It's got to be some kind of internal heat. And but yet, over a large area around the South Pole, figure A shows you that that bright patch is right centered on the South Pole, and it's 85 Kelvin. But there's more. If you examine the spectrum of light coming from this hot patch, warm patch, let's call it, the spectrum does not fit a black body at 85 Kelvin. It's got a component of that emission coming from a small area in that South Polar region that's a lot hotter. And so over at B, you can see the probable temperature of that small component within the field of view, and it could be 135 Kelvin. And the slide 29 shows when we got even closer and scanned right across one of these tiger stripes. Look at C there near the bottom. It got up to 90 Kelvin in the field of view, which is represented by the little box. But when you look at the spectrum, so this would be over at E, you can see that there's a component there occupying a few percent of the area that's probably 145 Kelvin, which is much hotter than sunlight could possibly produce and implies quite an internal heat flow coming up from inside the satellite. And that internal heat flow implies a temperature gradient inside the satellite. In other words, it has to be warmer inside than the surface. And you can ask, okay, if it's getting warmer as you go down, that's the temperature gradient that's needed to supply this internal heat. If it's getting warmer as you go down, how far down do you have to go before it's 73 Kelvin? Well, that's the melting point of water. Answer? 10 meters. So just from this thermal conduction argument, it's very likely that at least in underneath these cracks, or at least some small part of them, there's liquid water in some crack 10 meters down. We don't know that for sure, but it's very hard to escape it. Now, the next slide is slide 31, which is sort of a cartoon of all of that. And I really have two things to say. This is my last slide, I believe. One is that you've got liquid water near the surface. You've got some communication to the outside. So you've got a hydrologic cycle. Therefore, you've got chemical energy. You've got organics. You've got liquid water. It makes Enceladus a interesting place to consider the possibility of habitability and the possibility that life possibly could have developed here. So that's entirely speculative. The mystery, I think the biggest mystery, is what maintains all this activity? Where does the energy come from? What keeps the interior hot? And we don't know. Our best, maybe not our best models, but the models that we had in our libraries before we went by Enceladus said that they predicted about 10% of the amount of heat that we see coming out of the South Pole. And so we're still off by an order of magnitude in explaining what keeps Enceladus hot. And the last slide says the end, but it's not the end, because we are going to go on observing Enceladus. We're in orbit around Saturn, and we can get plenty of chances, and it's going to be an exciting time. If you go to the very, don't go, but after this talk is over and everyone's done, go to the very back of the presentation and you'll see some written notes of mine. And with that, I would like to, I think in the interest of time, I won't ask for questions, but I'd like to introduce Dr. Elizabeth Turtle, who's an associate of the imaging team and will tell us about icy satellites. Her name is Zibby.
Thanks, Andy. So the icy satellite portion of the presentation picks up on page 32. It's just a summary of information. And in the interest of time, I'm just going to skip through to the actual slides about each of the satellites that we've had close targeted, or at least targeted flybys of, in the past year. There were several flybys that were quite close to a number of the satellites last fall, and so that's been very exciting. The first one, which was actually a rather distant flyby, but was the closest we'll get to MIMAS during the nominal tour, was last August. MIMAS, in stark contrast to Enceladus, is a very old, heavily cratered body. It's a little closer to Saturn than Enceladus, but not a lot, and they're about the same size. It's a little smaller than Enceladus.
Listen to it.
So that contrast is very interesting. You can see by the various images on slide 33, the heavily cratered surface and the one large 140-kilometer diameter crater, Herschel. The formatting on some of these slides is actually in the transition. Somehow things got a little messed up, so I apologize for the fact that the text in some of them is white on white, or in fact over some of the images. But hopefully there'll be enough that's visible to make sense of it. The next close flyby of one of the satellites was at the end of September. There was a close flyby of Tethys. This is slide 34. Tethys is much larger than Enceladus and Mimas, and is also a very ancient satellite. You can see in the upper left an image of the Odysseus crater, which is a few hundred kilometers in diameter. And on the upper right, there's an image of Ithaca Chasma, which is a huge, several-kilometer-deep fracture that runs most of the way along, it runs about three quarters of the way around around Tethys. This is one of a view of an area that Voyager hadn't seen, and with the observations that we've gotten from the various flybys of Tethys in the past year, we're getting more information about the status of that. Now, you can clearly see here that even though it is fractured, it's a very old surface. There are a lot of impact craters on that fracture, on that that large fracture. In the lower left is a much closer image of Tethys. And you can see that that there's in some of the craters there's been landsliding or slumping of material down onto the floor. So it's even though it's an ancient cratered surface, there has been some modification since those craters were formed. Right after the Tethys flyby, there was a very close flyby by a small irregular satellite called Hyperion. And on slide 35 are a couple of the images from that. Hyperion is a very dramatic surface. It looks completely different from anything we've seen in the solar system, and is just very strange. It looks like there's very dark material that's concentrated in the low areas in the bottoms of some of the craters, and there's a lot of, you can see in the image on the left, which shows the whole of Hyperion, that there are a lot of craters that have formed on slopes that have been degraded. It's a fascinating surface. There's a very high-resolution mosaic on the right-hand side of the slide that shows a strip across the surface and some of the details. It shows that there are, in fact, some very small but bright craters within the dark material, which can help us constrain the thickness of the dark deposits at the bottom of those craters. At the bottom of the slide, there are actually a couple of links. There's a movie that kind of pans across some of the images of Hyperion, and I'm not going to show that here, but there are links to those movies listed there. Kind of, it's a dramatic view of the surface. The next close flyby was just a couple weeks later in October, and was a very close flyby of Dione, which again is one of the middle-sized satellites. Now, Dione you can see on the upper left, there's an image of Dione that has craters, but there's some parts of the surface that are not heavily cratered. So it looks substantially different from Tethys, which is about the same size. There's some areas that are fractured and faulted, and during this... In the very early part of the Cassini mission, the wispy terrain that you kind of see in the color image at the top and a little bit on the image at the right was demonstrated to be fractures. During this very close flyby last October, we actually got very close views, very high-resolution views of these fractures, and some of those are shown at the bottom. And you can see the bright fractures cutting across the craters there. And in fact, if you look closely at the one on the bottom left, which unfortunately is covered because the text got moved around in the formatting, they're bright irregular fractures that run from kind of the upper right down to the lower left. And then there's a set of really fine dark fractures that run fairly straight from upper left to lower right. And so we can see that there in not only are fractures on the surface, but there are multiple generations of fractures. So Dione clearly has had some level of activity, of tectonic activity, much more recently geologically than some of the other satellites like Tethys. And very intriguingly, the magnetometer on Cassini found a signature similar to the signature that it found near Enceladus. Now, it's a much lower level, and there's only been one flyby that they've had, that there's only been the one close flyby of Dione, so we need to look into this more, but it's very intriguing there may be more to Dione as well. Then in November, there was another very close flyby of a satellite. This one is close to Rhea. Rhea is another very ancient surface. You can see a number in the upper left. There are a number of large impact basins on the surface. And in the lower left is a very high-resolution image from this flyby that shows just craters upon craters on the surface. There's also, the image on the upper right shows a bright rayed crater. This means that the crater is was formed very recently, and there's still deposits that it, that were of material that were thrown out during the cratering event strewn across the surface. These tend to fade with time, and you can see that most of the craters don't have this kind of these kind of rays around them, but this one young one does. And the image at the lower left is actually the rim of that crater, which is about 50 kilometers in diameter. So you can see the very sharp of that crater, and in fact you can see superimposed upon it a lot of little craters as well. These are probably secondaries from an even more recent impact. And the last slide I have for the satellites that aren't Enceladus or Titan that we've encountered in the last year is just a set of images of the best views we've had to date, and in many cases during the entire planned for the entire nominal mission of a lot of the smaller satellites of Saturn. Excuse me. In the upper left is Theodora, which is one of the Ephraim Shepherds. The upper right, there's an image of Janus, and in the distance, so there's Janus and then the rings, and in the distance is Prometheus, which is the other Ephraim Shepherd. The bottom sets of images, Calypso is the one at fairly low resolution on the left, and this is one of the Trojans of Tethys, and Telesto, which is the other Trojan of Tethys, on the right, and there were a number of fairly close flybys for these satellites, and intriguingly, they all seem to have fairly smooth surfaces, as if material has been mantled, as if the surface is mantled by material that's been deposited on the surface, and it's kind of smooth. It's intriguing. So I'm going to move on to Titan now. To talk about Titan's surface, the observations we've made of the surface in the last year. Slide 39 is again just a kind of overview of information about Titan, and slide 40 just lists the Titan encounters we've had so far. There were several in the first year, in Cassini's first year at Saturn. In the last year, we've had another 9. And in fact, in the next year, there are going to be 19 flybys of Titan. So it's really ramping up the how quickly we have to turn around between flybys of Titan. Slide 41 just shows what Titan looks like to the naked eye on the left. It's mostly we see its atmosphere. But if we look in windows in methane, which is one of the components of Titan's atmosphere, in the near infrared and infrared, we can see down to its surface. And so those two views are just what Titan looks like in the near infrared at 938 nanometers, and then in true color. With the imaging system, we've been building up a map of the surface of Titan, and based on the observations of the various instruments of the surface, a number of names have been suggested for features on the surface. And so slide 42 shows the map we have so far. Now you'll notice in the bottom where there's actually a Latlon grid over the map that this cuts off at about 30 north, and that's because it's still northern winter, and so the illumination near the northern hemisphere, in the upper northern hemisphere, is still not sufficient to image well there. So the map will be expanding northward as we get closer to northern spring. The next slide shows a map of the surface made by the Visual and Infrared Mapping Spectrometer. This is a color map using 3 of the windows in the infrared. So this is false color because each of these windows is in the infrared. But it shows that there are spectral variations on the surface. And at this point, there's a lot of work going on to try to identify what those spectral variations mean.
What slide number, please, again?
I'm sorry. This is slide 43.
Thank you.
But the fact that they exist is significant. There's a lot of material is likely to precipitate out, a lot of complex hydrocarbons are likely to precipitate out of Titan's atmosphere because of chemical reactions in the atmosphere. And so the fact that the whole surface doesn't look completely uniform indicates that material is moving around and that there are variations on timescales shorter than that material is falling out of the atmosphere. So on the tens of years timescales, which is very intriguing. The slides 44 and 45 show better views of the 44 is the sub-Saturnian hemisphere, and these are ones that we've overlaid names on. These two images. You can see in the equator there a lot of these regions that have a lot of very dark areas and bright areas. At the mid-latitudes there actually is less variation in the albedo of the surface. You can see the same thing in slide 45, which is an image that was taken, a mosaic that was taken last October, which again is a higher resolution view of the so far in the mission, there have been a handful of flybys with radar synthetic aperture, with synthetic aperture radar observations. And slide 46 shows those data superimposed on the map of Titan. The blue map in the background is actually from HST, because, as I mentioned, we haven't seen those areas well yet with the other instruments because of the illumination. And the gray map is that same ISS map, the imaging map from Cassini. So there are five strips of the SAR across the surface, and I'm going to speak to T7, T8, and T13, which are the ones that we have acquired in the last year. So T7 is actually a fairly southerly path. You can see it just on the lower right of slide 46. And slide 47 shows some close-ups of the radar data there. These are, you can see in them channels running across the surface, and you can see that the morphology of the channels changes, which is very intriguing because that is controlled by the style of precipitation, for example, and the material properties of the surface that's being eroded by the liquid flowing across the surface. And the radar team actually hypothesized that the boundary that one can see in the lower image on slide 47, where it's bright on the left-hand side and then dark on the right, might actually be an ancient shoreline of sorts. I should say that in all the time that Cassini's been at Saturn, one of the goals is to try to look for liquids on the surface of Titan, and so far we haven't found any conclusive evidence with Cassini of liquids on the surface. And in fact, moving on to the next slide, the T8 observation, this is slide 48. This covers the very dark region on the anti-Saturnian hemisphere. And full of what had been identified early on in the one of the earlier radar passes as they've been described as cat crashes, these linear, dark linear features that run across the surface. And the T8 swath here really demonstrated that these are dunes running across the surface of Titan, longitudinal dunes. So they're actually going in the same direction as the prevailing wind direction. And these dominate the very dark areas on the surface of Titan. So rather than being seas of liquid, they've been described as seas of sand. Now, of course, it's not sand as we're familiar with it. It's a sand-sized particles, perhaps, but not made of silicates, but made of ice or hydrocarbon particulates. On the lower right of this slide 48, you can see that there are actually chains of bright features, and these are topographic highs, a few to several hundred meters high, And so that may be suggestive of tectonic activity on the surface as well. Also on T8, the part of that swath actually was extended to the radar observation was extended to actually cover the Huygens landing site. And slide 49 shows some images of some images showing that comparison. On the upper right, for example, you can see the mosaic from DISR, the Descent Imaging Spectral Radiometer on Huygens, overlaid on the radar swath, and you can see at a little above halfway up that image, there are two dark lines. Those are actually two cat scratches, or two of these longitudinal dunes, and it turns out that DISR actually imaged them as well, which is really neat. The two panels in the upper center actually just show where the landing site is within the radar swath. And then I included a couple of images more recently processed by the DISR team. The one on the left shows the moon in a similar perspective to those images that Huygens returned from the surface of Titan. And there's been a lot of the one in the bottom center shows some stereo data. There's been a lot of detailed analysis of the Huygens data, and it's the surface. There's stereo pairs that show that the surface is very rugged. The slopes in between these channels are 30 degrees. It's about the angle of repose, and the topography in there is a few hundred meters high. There are a number of videos, in fact, that Huygens has, that DISR has released in the past month or so, and I've put links, the URLs to link to some of those at the bottom of this slide. The most recent radar pass was T13, which is just a month or two ago. This actually covered Xanadu, the bright region that was actually identified about a decade ago in ground-based observations, the HST observations of Titan's surface. This is a fascinating swath. It again shows channels on the surface in a very rugged area. In fact, some of the results that were presented at the meeting last week suggested that the surface has topography similar to, or slopes similar to those observed by Huygens, these kind of 30-degree angle of repose slopes, but more height, so several hundred meters to kilometer height. So it's a very rugged region. One of the other things that's really really fascinating about this is it provides one of the best comparisons we've got between imaging data of the surface and the radar data of the surface. And there's a link, again, on this, there's a URL listed there that shows a comparison between Shikoku facula and Guabanito facula. Guabanito is a ring, and Shikoku is the region that we've been referring to as Great Britain for quite a while. And it's really fascinating. In the interest of time, I won't go through that here, but it's really fascinating to see how the observations are different and similar. There's some places where things that are bright in both, and there's some places where they're not, especially including a circular feature that appears in the radar in Shikoku facula, but doesn't appear in the near IR observation. So that's going to be very helpful in trying in terms of trying to understand the surface of Titan. So that was a bit of a whirlwind, but hopefully you got a flavor of what we've been discovering on the surfaces of the satellites in the past year. And I will turn it back over to Dr. Andy Ingersoll to talk about Saturn's atmosphere.
All right. My computer is frozen up here, but the first slide, you can see it, slide 51, some Saturn facts. The most interesting facts that I want you to think about are that Saturn, the third bullet from the bottom, Saturn has a density less than that of water, which means that it's made out of very lightweight stuff. In fact, it's made out mostly of hydrogen helium. It's a big ball of gas. In fact, it and Jupiter are called the gas giants because of this fact that they're made out of gas. They have some other things inside, like water vapor and methane and ammonia, but the main constituents are hydrogen and helium. And the cloud patterns that we see have this banded appearance, all lined up with the latitude and longitude, which means that the rotation of the planet is controlling the patterns. We measure the winds relative to the inside of the planet, just the way we measure winds on Earth relative to the solid planet. We have to find some reference frame to measure the winds, and the reference frame has been in use since the Voyager times. Says that the cloud motions that we see make Saturn the windiest planet in the solar system. That whole subject is up for grabs, and it's shifting, and Don Mitchell will tell you about that in a few minutes. Let's move on to slide 52, and in fact, let's move to slide 53, which shows the same thing. So, on slide 53, which is not numbered, you can see on the left is 0.90 microns reflected sunlight, and you can see the faint cloud bands. You can also see the shadows of the rings on the planet up in the north running sort of diagonally, but the cloud bands run horizontally in this image, and they're fairly hazy. But if we look at 5 microns, which is the right image, you see all this structure. And what you're seeing here is holes in the clouds that let infrared radiation from deeper, warmer levels escape to space. But it's obviously we're seeing clouds that are deeper than the clouds we see in visible light. And this has gotten us all excited because one of the mysteries or one of the unknowns about the meteorology of Saturn is what's going on in the deeper fluid underneath what we see. And so now it appears that if we look at 5 microns with the VIMS, we can see these deep clouds and maybe measure the winds. Moving right along here to the next slide. Oh God, my computer is not working too well. Shows the same thing, and we can peer. There's a lot more structure in this deep cloud that we can see. That little red box up in the left has been expanded in the down on the right, and there's a lot of structure. And we can't see structure like that in the visible. It's much, much more muted. All right, moving to slide 55, you see a sort of a montage of different images that were taken in visible light by the imaging. The one in the center at the bottom is especially interesting because it was taken not using sunlight to illuminate the planet, but it was taken on the night side of the planet where there isn't any sunlight, but there's light reflected off the rings. So we're basically using ring shine the way you might use moonshine to make photographs at night, except that the rings are so big and they cover the scene so thoroughly that ring shine is actually brighter than the full moon at Earth. You could definitely read a paper by ring shine at Saturn. And so that strange storm that almost looks like a face tilted over is a storm that we saw in ring shine. Now actually, we were told to look for that storm by another instrument on the spacecraft, the RPWS, the radio wave instrument, and they were seeing what to them looked like the radio signals from lightning flashes. And they said, "We're getting lightning, we're detecting lightning in the radio. We want you guys to look for the storm that's producing it." And we said, "Well, we can't because the spacecraft is looking at the night side right now." And then they said, "Well, tough. We'll ask the amateur astronomers to see if they can see the storm." And the amateur astronomers found the storm first. And then we went and looked at our night side images and found, yes, we could see it too by ring shine. The next slide, which is 56, shows some of the... what is 56? It shows a time sequence of this storm, the we called it the Dragon Storm in 2004. We've been watching a similar storm in 2006, and it's very active. And when it's most active, as measured by the brightness and the motion, that's when the radio signals are the greatest. Now, slide 57 shows you a time history in 2004 of the radio signals. Each spike is the radio signals, and they're spaced 10 hours and some minutes apart because that's the rotation of Saturn. And every time the storm is on the spacecraft facing side, you get these radio signals, and then Saturn rotates, and the radio signals die away. And indeed, it all matches up, and it appears that we've got a very powerful thunderstorm or cluster of thunderstorms on Saturn. The radio signals from this storm are brighter, more powerful than anything on Earth. We don't quite understand why the lightning storm should be so much greater on Saturn than on Earth or Jupiter. Okay, moving on to slide 58, shows a picture of the auroras in Saturn's northern and particularly southern hemisphere. These pictures were taken 1 hour apart, and if you look carefully in the southern hemisphere, you can see changes in the structure of the aurora, which probably represent the response of the aurora to changes in the solar wind. What's going on with the aurora is that electrically charged particles are flowing in, following the magnetic field of Saturn, and they're flowing in, and accelerated by the electric fields, actually, but they're guided by the magnetic field, and they crash into the places where the magnetic field guides them onto the atmosphere, and that produces a glow in the ultraviolet, which is what you're seeing here. This is taken by the ultraviolet spectrometer, and I think Don Mitchell will have some more to say about that. Next slide, slide 59, shows further studies of some of these mapping where the spacecraft was and in connection with where the aurora was seen. Slide 60 is just a picture of the winds as we have been interpreting them. But that all depends. And you'll notice that the equatorial wind is 450 meters per second, which is about 1,000 miles an hour and is 10 times stronger than the jet streams on Earth. So this is a mighty big wind, and Don Mitchell, who comes next, is going to tell us that maybe the reference frame that we've been using for the inside of the planet, which, from which we measure the cloud motion, has been wrong, or it's changing, or something's going on, and so maybe these winds have to be, if anything, increased. But I'll leave that to Don. We can measure the cloud motions, and then he's got to tell us what the proper reference frame to use in turning them into winds. Don Mitchell is a co-investigator for the Magnetospheric Imaging Instrument.
Don. Yeah. Hello. I'm in the first slide that I've got. It's again a word slide. I'm going to skip over that, and you can look at it at your leisure later if you have questions about the general framework that I'm working in. But the next slide is slide 62. Shows a cartoon of the magnetosphere, and I mean, first thing you can see is it's a huge volume. I mean, it dwarfs Saturn. It's the dayside extent of the magnetosphere is out around 30 to 40 Saturnian radii. Sometimes it's being pushed in as close as 20 around Titan's orbit by the solar wind pressure, which is variable. The magnetic field of Saturn controls this space and separates it from the solar wind. Titan's orbit is fairly near the magnetopause, which is the boundary between the solar wind and the magnetosphere on the day side. And Titan goes around and sometimes actually goes out into the shock solar wind, although we have not encountered Titan in that region yet. We've been inside the magnetosphere for every Titan encounter we've seen so far. The magnetosphere of Saturn is superficially like other magnetospheres, like Earth, like Jupiter's, but they're all, of course, different from one another. And what really sets the magnetosphere of Saturn apart from the others is the amount of dust and especially cold gas that co-spatial with the energetic particles in the magnetosphere. So the red in the outer part of this is hot plasma, hot. Tens of kilovolts and down to a few kilovolts of energy of hydrogen and oxygen primarily. And as you get into the inner magnetosphere, there's sort of an inner boundary inside of which most of these tens of kilovolt particles are gone, and you only have very low energy particles and very high energy particles. And the reason they're gone is because the gas densities get so high that they absorb the charge exchange with the ions, and the ions are lost from the system. And Enceladus, of course, is the main contributor to that gas cloud. So the existence of Enceladus and its unique geology really are large, major modifiers to the kind of magnetosphere we see at Saturn. On the next slide, which is slide 63, this shows a cartoon of some of the work that was done on mapping some of the energetic particle observations in the magnetosphere with the auroral observations. These are Hubble Space Telescope auroral observations. They were not taken simultaneously with the particle data, but we have a certain number of auroral images from Hubble. And from that, we have at least some measure of the variability of the aurora at Saturn and where its sort of standard pattern is. And so what we did was looked at where we were measuring beams of electrons in the magnetosphere with Cassini, and then using magnetic field models developed in part using Voyager data and in part using Cassini data, we mapped where those particles would have come from if they come from the atmosphere. And they map back fairly close to these auroral regions, which indicates that we have not only, well, it may indicate, well, there's some dispute on this, but anyway, to get electron beams out in the magnetosphere, one mechanism to do that is to have electric fields which accelerate the electrons upward out of the ionosphere of Saturn. Those would be in close proximity to electric fields which are accelerating electrons down into the atmosphere and creating the auroral displays. And this happens at Earth all the time. You get dark regions and bright regions in the aurora, which are alternate upward and downward electric fields accelerating electrons either upward or downward. So this was the first observation of beams like this at Saturn. In the next slide, the radio wave emissions, as Andy, I think, referred to, have been used to as a proxy for the rotation period and the rotation frequency of Saturn. And as the assumption back in the Voyager days was that since the Saturn kilometric radiation, which is an emission that's caused by some of the auroral physics at Saturn, was very strongly modulated at a particular frequency, which was obviously very close to Saturn's rotation period, it was then adopted as Saturn's rotation period on the assumption that there was some asymmetry in the Saturnian magnetic field that was rotating with the interior of the planet and then expressed out in space as these radio emissions that were periodic. And so this was assumed to be the period of the interior and therefore a reference frame against which to measure the velocities of the winds that Andy referred to. Well, actually, even before Cassini arrived, we knew there was a problem with this because the period was drifting, and that was seen on the Ulysses spacecraft, which is also able to measure these emissions from Saturn. And then Cassini has since confirmed the Ulysses observations and pinned them down more tightly, and the period just seems to be moving. Even during the Cassini mission, it has changed by a little bit, and the total change from Voyager till now is up to 1% of the rotation period. Well, that's way too much. That's a much too large a change for it to be the entire body of Saturn changing its period by 1%, because the conservation of angular momentum just won't let you do that. There are no forces around that's going to change Saturn's rotation period by that much. So now we've got a quandary as to exactly what is rotating at this period and what the proper reference frame for those winds may be. I would say now, at this point, we don't have any measure that tells us uniquely what the interior rotation period is, and therefore the winds are a bit of a free function. We have to pick a period, maybe, and we may have to work backwards and decide, well, what's a reasonable wind pattern for the physics that we understand generates winds, and then pick a rotation period out of that. Not very satisfactory, but with this period drifting around, it's going to be hard to use it as a reference frame. The next slide, 65, just shows a confirmation of that standard of that period from the directly measurements of the magnetic field by Cassini. This is the first time we've got as well defined a frequency of a disturbance in the magnetic field itself. And this was published in Nature by Gampieri et al. Recently. And the frequency that they come up with is sort of right in the middle of what the radio frequency was during this same epoch. So although it's a different period than what was published for the radio observations, that's just because the radio people hadn't published from this particular period, and if they look at this particular period, it matches very closely what the magnetic field analysis shows. The next slide is a montage that relates the jetting from Enceladus of these particles and gases into the surrounding magnetosphere and its effects on the magnetosphere. In particular, there's this gas cloud, which was described earlier as being, I think Andy showed, in the vicinity of Enceladus orbit, peaking in that vicinity. It spreads out to roughly out to 8 to 10 Saturnian radii outward and cuts off at around 3 Saturnian radii on the inside. And in that same region of space, the upper right-hand panel indicates the composition of the charged particles in the inner magnetosphere and shows that the water products, OH, H2O, and H3O, and oxygen, when taken together, constitute a higher fraction of the ions there than hydrogen does, whereas in the outer magnetosphere, like Earth, hydrogen is the dominant species. These water products dominate the inner magnetosphere in the vicinity of this gas cloud, and they no doubt are derived from ionization of this gas cloud. The next slide shows a superposition of the gas cloud on energetic particle data that was taken during the Saturn orbit injection orbit, and these energies are running up to this energy scale is logarithmic, and they go up to about 220 kilovolts and down to, at the lower end, at about 3 kilovolts. This is hydrogen, and the oxygen looks very similar in morphology. And right between 6RS and 6RF, which is I've indicated on the bottom axis, we get down to about 1 Saturn radius, but there simply aren't any particles in this energy range inside of about 6RS because of the gas cloud, which, while it's producing the plasma in the magnetosphere, is also absorbing the energetic particles in that part of the magnetosphere very effectively and keeping the inner magnetosphere much lower in energetic particle flux than it typically would be if this gas cloud were not there. The next slide is a tutorial which just shows the charge exchange interaction, which is important to what follows. At all the planets, there's an interaction between trapped ions and full gases in the same space. And an ion that is spiraling about a magnetic field because of the Lorentz force on it can charge exchange, pick up an electron from an ambient cold gas particle, and when it does so, it will become a neutral particle, but it will retain its energy. There's very little energy transfer because the mass of the electron is so low. So the charged particle becomes a fast neutral, which then escapes from the system because it no longer feels the magnetic force. So you can think of the entire magnetosphere region emitting these fast neutral atoms. And the rate of emission is going to depend upon the number, the intensity of the charged particles and the gas density. It's that combination that gives you this product. The next slide is just an indication of a gas cloud, which this is now a hydrogen gas cloud, not the oxygen gas cloud I was talking about before. And for reference, I've got the blue oval is Titan's orbit, so that's out at 20 Saturnian radii. And this hydrogen cloud is much more extensive and goes out to 45 to 50 Saturn radii, even beyond that. And I've sketched in a particular geometry here where the magnetotail would be. The sun would be to the lower right in this image, so it sort of windsocks the magnetotail up and to the left as it during this summer season we're in. And I've placed Cassini in the image because the following slide will show images of the emission of these fast neutral atoms from the magnetosphere and this interaction between the ions and the gas. So this next slide shows a representative image like that. It shows the sun to the lower right and the tail region back where the magnetotail is the brighter region, and we've seen this as a repeatable signature in this emission. So there seems to be a reservoir of more energetic charged particles back in the magnetotail region. We really haven't explored that region yet, but with these images, these remote images of the system, we've been able to see that they're back there and anticipate measuring them in situ when we get there. The next slide shows emissions in that region that were much more concentrated and brighter in both hydrogen and oxygen. This was published in Geophysical Research Letters back in June of 2005, and that was a bit of a surprise to see the oxygen as bright as it was back there, since oxygen is a much smaller constituent of the general charged particle population back there. But it seems to be much more efficiently accelerated. And then the next slide shows a composite of images in the lower left from that same time period, which, again, the magnetotail stretching away to the upper left and the sun to the lower right in each of these images. And in this time sequence, you can see the magnetosphere going from a rather quiescent state to a very great brightening back in the tail region, and then that generation of charged particles is picked up in Saturn's rotational motion and flung around Saturn as the charged particles travel over Titan, which is in their path as they're co-rotating around Saturn. They envelop Titan, and you get a very dramatic brightening of the emission as the cloud moves over Titan, which is in the sort of the center image of this sequence. And that's because Titan is carrying along with it its own neutral atmosphere, which is a very dense gas that sits around it and produces a large emission of these energetic neutral atoms as they come off of it. And the upper right is an example of a Titan image when we're approaching Titan in a close encounter with Titan, and you can see this emission from the upper atmosphere as that dense neutral gas charge exchanges the energetic ions in the vicinity of Titan and produces this bright emission around Titan. And then the last of the slides that I have a framework for a movie that you could have downloaded and watched. It's just a reference slide for that movie. It's the first frame of it. But the movie includes the data from the previous slide and much more. Allows you to go through the time sequence and watch the development of that event as it goes along. So with that, I'll turn this talk over to Jeff. I guess if there are any questions that people would like to ask now, they can, but otherwise Jeff Cuzzy will continue with the ring. Thanks.
Okay, on here. Thank you, Don. Okay, so the first slide is a bunch of bullets of things that I'm sure you all know, so I really won't dwell on it, and I'm just going to go right to the next slide. And this will remind you a little bit of what the rings look like, just from the nomenclature standpoint. The innermost ring there designated the C-ring. I'm not sure. Let me just go back, see which. Okay, this would be slide number 75, and it's not numbered. This is actually a semi-correct color composite of the rings. The brightest ring there is called the B ring. It's full of structure that we don't understand. The outermost ring is the A ring. And just outside the A ring, we have this little narrow stranded thing called the F ring. The Cassini division between the A ring and the B ring and the C ring, which is the innermost ring, are very similar in a lot of their properties, and I'll have more to say about that later. And just to remind you that the structure in here, almost none of the structure is understood. Little gap in the outer part of the A-ring is the location of an embedded moonlet called Pan, and a very almost invisible thread-like dark line at the very outer edge of the A-ring is another little gap where we have discovered another little moonlet, which I talked about last year. Okay, so that's what the rings look like on the lit side. This is what they look like from the unlit side on the next slide. And what you see here is the darkest thing, which is the B ring. It's dark because very little light actually gets through. And the Cassini division, which is in the middle of the frame, and the C ring over to the right are actually bright because you're actually seeing illuminated particles from the unilluminated side. This is sort of just an orientation picture. You see the little red box in there shows you the field of sort of the next image, which is... Now you can click the next image, and here what you see is actually our first discovery of spokes from Cassini. This happened last fall, right around September. And we have been not seeing spokes. Spokes are sort of shadowy, finger-like structures on the rings. The rings are just covered with these things, as seen by Voyager. They've been seen from Hubble. But then as the rings continue to get more and more open to the Earth and the Sun, the Hubble sort of stops seeing them. They gradually vanish and fade from sight. That's a bit of a mystery as to why that is. It's thought that it has to do with solar illumination of the rings and charging of the rings. Actually, sunlight pops little electrons up off the rings, so it creates a negative charge around them and an electric field between them and the material around them. So any little dust grains get popped off into this charged environment get immediately sucked right back down onto the rings, and we tend not to see spokes. So by that theory, we should expect to start seeing spokes again when the elevation angle to the rings tilts down again, probably in a year or two. But this all happened right before Cassini went into equatorial orbits, as seen in the next slide, and basically this is what we've been looking at for the next 9 months, for the last 9 months with the orbiter. This is terrific geometry for the atmospheric people to study the cloud bands, as Andy described to you. It's rather boring from the standpoint of ring people. So we have been making use of the time actually going back and analyzing data and having a lot of fun turning up discoveries and data that got taken months and months and months ago that we just hadn't really had a chance to look at. But As of this summer, late July, Cassini will again reemerge from the equator plane for about a year of highly inclined orbits, and we'll be back in business. Okay, next slide. I want to just remind you, I showed you the main rings there. There we also have these very diffuse rings. There's this on the top panel. There's this very diffuse band, the E-ring, which is sort of centered on the satellite Enceladus that you've heard all about. And then just inwards of that, between that and the main rings, is a thinner ring called the G-ring. Well, this the three panels down at the bottom show the G-ring, and they actually show what Cassini has discovered as an arc in the G-ring. That is, it's not a symmetric structure. It's got this sort of anomalously bright region, and in the left-hand frame sort of indicated where the arrow is, so it's sort of rotating around counterclockwise from lower right at the left picture to sort of right at the onset, or the rightmost curve of the ring in the center picture, and then it's moved around a little bit to the far arm in the right-hand picture. This arc, it turns out, is right at the very inner edge of the G-ring, and we're starting to try to get some periods on it right now and try to figure out if it's tied to some satellite or other, but it's definitely a new discovery from Cassini. Enceladus, I'm not going to say much about because everybody else has talked about it, but we do know now Enceladus definitely is the source of the E-ring. Next slide shows some measurements of the E-ring from inside the E-ring by the CDA, the Cassini Dust Analyzer. We're actually, you know, we're orbiting in the E-ring for quite a bit of time, especially this one orbit. This data is taken from orbit number 15, which is an equatorial orbit. So we're actually just in the E-ring the whole time and just coming out briefly. So the CDA can get beautiful data on the radial structure of the E-ring in terms of the number of particles per unit volume. The vertical structure on the upper left here, which actually shows if you look at the points, there is actually a hint of a double peaked profile there, which is similar to what we see at Jupiter in very faint rings of Jupiter, that is, because like any harmonic oscillator, like a ball on a spring going up and down, you know, or a child on a swing, you know, the child on the swing, let's say, spends more time at the extreme points on its swing back and forth than in the middle. So these particles actually tend to spend more time either at plus or minus vertical distances from the exact midplane, and that seems to be a little bit of a hint of what we're seeing there, along with a sort of a southern offset, which has to be understood. The bottom right-hand panel actually indicates that the orbits of these particles are nearly circular, but this particular data, if you see the legends on it, are actually taken out around 8 RS. So if you look up at the top plot, you see 8 RS, 8 Saturn radii, is all the way over to the right-hand side of the plot. It's not really in what you might call the Enceladus part of the E-ring, where we expect the particles are very eccentric because of a combination of sunlight and radiation forces. So this is very interesting that these particles are circular, but what's really going to be interesting is later on in the mission when CDA is able to make these orbital dynamic measurements in the E-ring proper. Okay, moving on to the next one. This is a sort of a composite here of various things. The top panel shows something Dave Seale showed right at the beginning, and the bottom right-hand panel shows sort of a close-up of the same structure. These are the strands of the F-ring, which, as I showed you, is just sort of outside of the A-ring. Now, these bright strands, this is sort of a mosaic taken in the longitude direction. The bright speck on the top panel all the way over at the right, this is slide number 82, is actually Prometheus itself. And so as we go to the left, we're looking downstream from Enceladus. This is stuff that's further and further away in the orbital direction from Enceladus. Enceladus is actually moving faster to the right than the ring material is.
Don't you mean Prometheus?
Prometheus is one of the two small ring moons just outside of Saturn's main rings.
You kept saying Enceladus.
No.
Okay, Prometheus.
This is Prometheus now. It used to be thought that there's actually another little moon called Pandora just on the outside of the F-ring. You can't see it in this picture, so there's one on the inside, one on the outside. It used to be thought these things were actually confining the F-ring. They were called the F-ring shepherds because of the idea like shepherds confine a flock of sheep. But now we know that's probably not the case. The F-ring is in a region where a lot of orbital chaos is going on, and I'll say more about that later. But what you see, these beautiful fan-like patterns here, and it was really kind of a puzzle. We call these things channels. They actually look like there's places where material is piling up and other places where material is being removed. it was kind of a puzzle as to what was going on there. In the bottom, in that right-hand lower picture where you can see Prometheus itself, and you can see its little bright crescent even in its dark side, you can actually tell that it's actually pulling a little piece of material away from the F-ring. So one thing people have actually done, and I encourage you to look at this movie, perhaps offline, it's called the F-ring movie, and I don't think I can actually show it from within the PowerPoint here. But go ahead and take a look at it, and what it shows is this this panel on the left shows us. It shows a group of ring particles in the F-ring, strands shown schematically, and Prometheus just inside it. And what you'll see in the movie is Prometheus moving in and out because its orbit is eccentric, and the entire F-ring also moving in and out because its orbit is eccentric as well. And you'll see the ring material flowing past Prometheus. And what you'll see is Prometheus carving out these channels, but as time goes on, the appearance of the channels actually changes with time. And you see, you know, sometimes they're open like we see them here in this picture, in this snapshot, and sometimes they close up and look more like pinwheels. So the whole nature of all the system is very dynamic, and it changes depending on how close Prometheus is to the F-ring as a function of time. So this is starting to become a little bit more well understood. Next slide shows some stuff that we still don't understand very well. The bottom, very messy looking panels are the F-ring again stretched out in longitude. In fact, it's repeated twice, so it's actually the F-ring and then the F-ring again to accentuate the fact that these blurry strands are in the nature of a spiral. That is, they're tilted from the orbital direction, and you can follow one around, and it wraps into the next frame. So this is actually a spiral, and it's believed that this is caused by some object actually going through the F-ring. And the object that may be responsible for all this chaos is this little thing called 2004S6, which is shown in these two panels at the top. Only you notice in one panel, the little object is all the way outside the F-ring, and in the other panel, it's actually inside the F-ring, closer to Saturn. So this thing actually crosses through the F-ring. Its orbit is very eccentric. And as it crosses through the F-ring, we think it probably hit something or dynamically perturbed the F-ring. So if you look at the bottom panel on this this messy thing down here, and step to the next slide, you'll see a big black X show up. And that is the longitude where it's been predicted that this little object, S6, actually went through the F-ring. So this is a very, very dynamic structure, changing all the time. Okay, so I want to move on to the next subject here, which is this. The label on this slide is in white, so you can't see it, but it's not a particularly impressive-looking slide, but the scientific content is very, very important. What this represents is discovery of little things buried inside the main rings. Now, this is inside. We know that there are moonlets called Pan and Daphnis that clear out these little gaps in the rings. The Encke gap is cleared by a moon that's about 10 kilometers across, which we can see. But here, this is stuff that's buried in the main rings. These little double dash structures that you see here, these little horizontal dashes that are slightly offset in each one of these panels, are slightly cleared regions that are caused when there's a little object right in the middle between those two dashes, maybe several hundred meters across, okay, a couple times the size of a football field, way too small to see. Even in these images, which were taken at orbit insertion, and they are the highest resolution images we will ever get, they're 50 meters per pixel. What we're seeing is little cleared regions just around some of these. Well, what do you call them? We don't really have a name for them yet. We're calling them propeller objects for short because they cause this structure. But there were four of them, four different ones seen, and you can do the statistics. Next slide kind of shows where these things fall. This is a size distribution plot where the solid line at the upper left kind of shows your normal type ring particles from centimeters to meters. And then down at the bottom right, you have the diamond, which shows the two moonlets that we know are there. And you might imagine a line running between the largest ring particle at about 10 meters and the moonlets that we see. And you see these shards, these propeller objects that we're seeing in the A-ring, these two symbols of the error bars, are not too far off that line. So the implication is there's a whole population of objects lying right in the main rings with sizes between tens of meters, hundreds of meters, kilometers, you know, extending all the way up to the biggest things that we can actually see, which are big enough to cause gaps. So it's a lot of these other things are not big enough to cause gaps, but it's very, very interesting that they're there. Okay, so I want to move on in the interest of time to, I skipped one. Okay, now this is an image that shows, now these are the collection of the stellar occultations we've had, now where a star is seen to go behind the rings by Cassini, and the UVIS takes very rapid sampling measurements to measure the brightness of the starlight, which samples effectively the amount of material in the rings on a very, very small spatial scale, tens of meters. And what you're kind of seeing here, sort of at the lower left and at the lower right, there are radial profiles of the amount of material in the A-ring, showing the outer edge of the A-ring, very abrupt, little notch where the Encke gap is, and then it's kind of flat, and then you go to the inner part of the A-ring, the optical depth of the abundance of material rises again, then it drops abruptly going down into the Cassini division. The color bar at the bottom also indicates optical depth, but you notice that depending on where you are around this clock, this azimuth variable, the optical depth in the middle part of the A-ring actually changes. It's much higher over on the right-hand side than it is over on the lower side, which is very interesting because it's saying that, you know, well, you're just, it's like looking through a comb at different angles. That's the interpretation. So let's just go to the next slide, and I'll jump to the bottom line and show you the interpretation here. We believe that in the middle, in fact, we know now, Cassini has demonstrated, that in the middle of the A-ring, the mass density of the particles is sufficiently high that the whole system wants to become gravitationally unstable and clump up and form bigger particles, maybe like how planets first formed in the solar system. But because these particles are too close to Saturn and they're moving with respect to each other, the ones that are closer to Saturn are moving faster than the ones that are further away, these clumps get stretched out into these finger-like structures. This has been modeled for many years, but this is really the first instance now that we can actually observe it. So now the next slide shows you that you can imagine looking through these finger-like structures at different azimuthal angles, and in some azimuthal angles you'll see the star better than in others. And this depends on the size, the width, and the vertical thickness of these fingers. Okay, so you can see there's some angles here where these things cover up the star very nicely. Okay, next slide actually shows how what we can learn now from all these occultations. We can learn basically the green shows the optical depth. If you like, if you make a simple model now that you have these fingers and you have an amount of material in the finger, which would be sort of the blue or the average, and then the green would show you the amount of material in the spaces between the fingers, and the red points show you something that we can learn, which is sort of the height of these fingers compared to their width. And so from all of these various occultations of the rings, we can actually see now how these things vary throughout the rings. We're getting a very three-dimensional picture here. Like, for instance, this is the A-ring going from 122,000 to 137,000 kilometers. You can see the gap where the Encke gap is at about 133,000. So this height, the thickness of these tubes, increases gradually and systematically as you go out in the rings to a maximum sort of in the outer A-ring, possibly because of a lot of density waves there to stir up the material. Very interesting stuff. Lots to see here. I'm going to have to move on because of time, though. But just to summarize that in a word, we are now starting to get really three-dimensional information on the rings on this micro scale of only tens of meters. Okay, this slide actually is just a reminder. This is the shadow of the rings on the planet. Just remember that the B-ring is very dense. There's this very, very dark band right through the middle of the B-ring where no light gets through. Next slide shows you we're starting to peek through that D dense material with the radio occultations to see really how dense they are in the middle. And what this shows is four panels where the radio occultation team has averaged their signal to different degrees just to see how deep you can get. And as they average it spatially more, the blue line, which represents the blue dashed line, which represents the noise level, moves down. And you can see that there are regions in the densest part of the B ring in the bottom right-hand panel where the amount of material here has a, what we call an optical depth greater than about 6, which means, you know, less than e to the minus 3 or, you know, I don't know, much less than a percent of material gets through. And there is still that one very dense part right around 106,000 kilometers where we're just not seeing anything. So that is a very interesting region to know what's going on in there. Okay, this next slide, number 93, just is a reminder that we're still taking temperatures of the rings with SEERs, and we're still measuring the composition of the rings with VIMS. And you can't really read the bottom, so I'm going to just go on to the next slide and show you an example of what VIMS can do. This is actually my last slide or pair of slides. These are spectra of the rings, that is, their brightness is a function of wavelength, mostly through the near-infrared, and as taken by the VIMS. And each different color line is a different region of the ring. So the higher brightness is to the top, it goes from 1 micron, 2 microns, 3 microns. The first thing you see is that all these spectra have these big, deep bands, these deep absorptions at about 1.6, 2 microns, and 3 microns. These are due to water. We've always known the rings are mostly water. This is not a surprise. But the different depths of these bands is really starting to tell us a lot of interesting stuff. Notice at about 1.2, 1.3 microns in the left-hand panel, there's a sort of a very weak band all the way to the left at about longer to 1 micron, and then there's another one at about 1.3 microns. And notice as you go down the plot, the depth of that band pretty much goes away, and it's quite deep in the purple line, which is the outer A ring, but then by the time you go down the red line at the bottom, which is the Cassini division, there is no water ice band. This is a very weak band. It's easily obscured by other pollutants like dirt or silicates or carbon or something. So what we're really seeing here is starting to see how the composition of the rings varies from one region of the ring to the next. And you can see that even comparing the left-hand panel to the right-hand panel. Now, the next slide indicates, this actually shows you where all the water ice bands are, and it also shows where there's a silicate structure. In the right-hand panel, you sort of see this curved rainbow-looking line here, this boomerang-shaped thing. The shape, that spectral shape, is diagnostic of silicates, and we're seeing it in the C-ring, and even maybe, certainly in the C-ring. You notice the shape of that spectrum is very different from the shape of the spectrum, the same spectral region, in the A-ring over on the left-hand panel. So things really do vary from place to place in the rings, and we're just starting to get a handle on that now. The question mark features down there might imply some kind of organic material. It's a little bit early to say right now. Okay, just to summarize, we have been focusing on data analysis. We're really understanding, I think, these curious channel structures in the F-ring and how they change with time. We've discovered these strands and how this marauding moonlet, you know, that was barely visible in the discovery image by Cassini, published in the Porco et al. Paper, is barely visible. Now it knocks your eye out. So that thing is probably changing with time, and it's going through the F-ring, and it's causing a lot of chaos. We found new kinds of objects, transitional-sized objects, in the main ring and also in the F-ring. The 3D holographic structure of the rings, we're starting to map this out now with all these occultations, and we're learning a lot about these gravitational instabilities. Finally, we're starting to get composition. We've seen structure and features, spectral features in the rings, like on some of these other moons that VIMS is observing, including Phoebe, which is thought to be sort of a captured comet. We found spokes, and we're looking forward to seeing the rings again starting in July. So that's all I had to say.
Okay, great. Thanks, Jeff, and everyone. The rest of the presentation, there's a few more charts about what to expect for year 3. I won't go over those. since you may have questions you're more interested in asking the scientists. There's also some charts that, again, Andy had to follow on with some of his discussion. I show about 5 minutes left, so, you know, if Andy wants to go over those, it's fine. Otherwise, we'll open for any questions you have for the scientists.
Go for the questions.
I have a question and comment.
Can you please say your name, please?
This is Matthew Ota with Observation Campaign.
Go ahead.
Yeah, this is for Jeff, just a comment about the ring spokes. Voyager, in my understanding, did not discover the ring spokes. They were actually observed prior to these spacecraft flights by an amateur astronomer named Stephen James Lemura, who actually is very famous for having a sharp eye. He was observing these spoke-like objects from Earth with a telescope, and it was confirmed by the Voyager mission images.
That is, you hear that. I'm very skeptical of that, frankly. There have been lots of claims of people seeing spoke-like structures in the rings going back, in fact, into the last century by various people. It's all in Alexander's book, but I don't know. The Hubble is by far the most sensitive thing, and I think the geometry, if I understand correctly, of when O'Meara was actually observing Hubble, just has never seen anything there. So I don't know. It's conceivable, but very hard to prove, as you know, with eyeball observation.
I beg the difference, since the Hubble isn't really comparable to the human eye in many respects. But we agree to disagree on that. Thank you.
Hi, this is Ken Kramer. I have a question about Titan. There was a lake you may have identified near the South Pole, and I'm wondering what's the latest thinking on that.
There haven't been any further observations of that area. The South Pole is, of course, a region where we had seen a lot of clouds, although there haven't been many clouds observed at Titan in the last year. But the fact that we'd seen clouds that looked like convective clouds would be consistent with precipitation in that region. The hope is that we'll get a better look at that on the 38th Titan flyby with the BIMS and ISS instruments, but that's still up in the air, actually. And the radar will see some areas near the South Pole on the 39th Titan flyby, which could help identify whether or not there are liquids on the surface there. Unfortunately, in terms of looking for specular reflections or something like that off the surface, something that close to the South Pole, we won't be able to do that with the camera, and I'm not even sure that BIMS would get an opportunity to do it. So there is no update specifically on that feature at this point.
Okay, thank you.
But hopefully in the future we'll get a better look at it.
I have another question, too, about Enceladus. When will we visit that again, and what more do we hope to learn?
Well, there are a number of sort of distant flybys, and we're going to be looking at the plumes from various angles and in various colors and try and get a better handle on the particle size. And then we have, in I think March of 2008, a close flyby of Enceladus in which we can do it all over again, and knowing what to look for, we ought to do a better job, get really high-resolution imaging and in-situ sampling with the INMS instrument. So it's just going to be spread out, but March 2008 is the big one.
This is Earl Kyle, Rochester, New York. I have a question for anybody. Can you hear me?
Yep.
With all the charged particles and other so-called radiation in the general vicinity of the planet Saturn, if at some point in the distant future human beings were to go to visit that region, how dangerous would it be from a radiation harmful effect to the human body point of view? Does anybody know?
This is Don. Mitchell, it's pretty benign compared with Jupiter and even compared with Earth because of the what Enceladus does to the charged particle populations. They're pretty weak at Saturn. There are energetic electrons that are high energy and some very high energy ions, so the region in between the orbit of Enceladus and the outer edge of the ring is kind of a dangerous place to go, radiation-wise. But any place that maps inside the ring would be extremely benign, and even the magnetosphere outside of Enceladus is fairly benign.
Thanks.
Thank you. Any further questions? Okay, we can end this then.
Okay, thanks you all for dialing in and listening. Hope to see you next time.
Goodbye.
Excellent telecom. Thank you.
Take care.
Hello? Hello?